This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome Kyle Dickman. He's contributing editor at Outside Magazine. He's a former hotshot firefighter, and he's author of the new book, On the Burning Edge, A Fateful Fire and the Men Who Fought It. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So this is the story of the tragic wildfire in Arizona in the summer of 2013, in which 19 firefighters, the Granite Mountain Hotshots, lost their lives. Many of our listeners have heard about this. And it's a book about so much more, beautifully written book. I mean, you cover firefighter culture, the nature and ecology of fire. First of all, what is a hotshot firefighter as opposed to any other firefighter?
Right. So hotshot firefighters tend to be 20-person crews. They're most people consider them elite teams, and their job is to travel anywhere around the country, and they'll fight the biggest and most dangerous fires, and tend to be wilderness fires. But more and more, those fires are burning closer to civilization. So
what does it take to do that job? What is the training like? And then when you're doing it, I mean, you've done it. What is the actual work like?
Well, the training is quite intense, and that's because the work is quite intense. So you spend the actual work is you spend a lot of time hiking to get into the fire's edge, and that means you'll carry a 30 or 40 or 55-pound pack, and you'll hike up steep hills for miles. And then when you get there, you'll be on the fire's edge, and you'll grab your tools, and you'll start cutting line. In effect, it looks like the work of a chain gang. And so some days you'll work 16 hours a day, and you'll do that for 2 weeks straight. And to get ready for that, the beginning of the season is often really intense, I mean, in terms of training. So those, when I was there, we would run 5 or 6 miles in the morning, and then we would do maybe 100 push-ups and 200 sit-ups and a bunch of pull-ups. And then after that, you go out and you cut line because, then you know, you practice like you were. And so,
what is cutting line?
Cutting line is it's basically removing any flammable vegetation right from the very edge of the fire. And so the idea is that fire, of course, needs fuel to burn. And so when you remove that fuel, the fire stops when it hits that edge.
How wide does the line have to be to stop a fire? I'm sure that depends on the fire.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It depends on the fire. I don't know if you saw in the news this last week, but a bunch of cars were burned up in California when a brush fire crossed a freeway. So that gives you an idea how wide a fire line, you know, has to be to stop a certain type of blaze. So hotshots tend to build fire lines that are, you know, maybe between 6 and 8 feet wide, and then that's actually, it's called clearing it down to mineral soil. So it's actually just dirt. That's what you're after. You're just dry dirt. And then outside of that is a swath that the chainsaws cut. And so that may be 20 to 40 feet wide, and that'll be clear of trees and brush. And so ultimately it looks like a Jeep trail sitting in the middle of a highway. That's maybe a good way to describe it.
So meanwhile, you are doing this when a fire is imminent or when a fire has already started, because you can't just do that work preventively because you wouldn't know where to do it because you don't know when a fire is going to start. So here you are, there's a fire, and then here are these guys cutting 8-foot-wide lines against time.
It's definitely a race against time. So the fire is often spreading pretty quickly. I mean, but, you know, a lot of times hotshots are able to do their best work at night when it's a little cooler and the humidity is a little higher and the fire behavior is calm. And so they're able to sort of make ground on the fire.
When you clear a fire to bare dirt, that must be incredibly hard work because you're taking out roots in forests that are not shallow.
Yeah, no, it's hard. It's hard. It is. It's hard. I think that's why the job tends to attract 20 to 30-year-olds. You know, I think most hotshot superintendents don't, you know, they'll retire by the time they're 45. And I don't know of any who have survived a career without any sort of major injuries. A lot of them have back pain or, you know, hurt shoulders or twisted knees, ACL tears, whatever it may be. But you know, they hike. They hike hundreds, maybe thousands of miles in really rough terrain every year, and that's what they love. You know, I mean, that's why they keep coming back to the job. While all of these things are hard, I mean, the flip side of that is that these guys get to work in the most beautiful places in the country. They just happen to be on fire.
I mean, you said a moment ago it's like a chain gang, and one of the it's just a detail of the book, but one that I found interesting was sometimes people that are on firefighting crews are actually prison inmates. They're really good workers, and then when they get released from jail, a lot of the time they'll walk right into that job.
Yeah, so that's a program that was started in the late 40s, and so I think it's a great program. And because the prisoners want that job because it gives them an opportunity to leave prison, and so they'll go out and they get to work fires for the summer, and it's for them, you know, just like it is for kids. It's a great adventure for them, and I think just like it is for a hotshot, I mean, they have to prove themselves capable of doing that work, and the only way to do it is to actually fight the fires. And I think once they've proven themselves capable, the inmates often leave prison and they don't necessarily have a whole lot of opportunities, and a lot of Forest Service crews know that if they've done the work on an inmate crew, then they're also capable of doing the work on the Forest Service crew.
There is quite a lot in the book which I found fascinating about the culture of hotshot firefighters, because you're not just always out there doing the work. There's the beginning of the day and the end of the day and the waiting and the, you know, camaraderie and the hazing and the pranks and the kind of pretty serious rough hazing that they do of rookies. I mean, did you experience this yourself?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, to be clear, I think the hazing is, it may not feel like it is, but I do think in general it's coming from a good place. I mean, the idea is that this is a weird thing to defend, but like the idea is that they I think most hotshots want to be sure that the man that they're working beside is going to have their back when things get really tough. Whether or not that requires like putting leaves into my sleeping bag and, you know, and crawling into them at night, or whether, you know, like they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't talk to me for 2 weeks, and it's sort of an isolating position to be a rookie on a hotshot crew, but I do think it has its place. I mean, it's the hotshots tend to believe, like anybody who's serious about their jobs, that they're the best at their jobs, you know. And I think part of that is really believing it, you know, and they believe it.
There's not a lot of women, none in this crew that you're writing about in the book, but there's not a whole lot of women doing this. But there are some. I had a friend who was a hotshot. And rough work, how does it change the dynamic when there's a woman on board?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. There aren't a lot of women who do it. And I think it's because there's so many men who do it. I think that, you know, they tend to get hazed a lot. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of sexual harassment, and whether, you know, it's like, it's a man's world out there, and that's just the truth. And I think the women who do it have to figure out how to cope with that. And a lot of, you know, I had, my first fire captain was a woman, and she was really well respected, and she was an excellent firefighter. But, you know, what she used to say is that you're either, this is going to be crass, but you're either a lesbian or you're a slut. And that's how the men on the fire line would treat the women. And so, I don't know if that's changed since the time I was on the line, but, you know, I know it was tough for her when she first started out.
And she earned her respect.
Oh, she earned her respect because she was able to, A, hang with the men, and then, B, I think in many cases she was better, right? She was a better firefighter when it came to tactics or logistics or operations, and now she's moved way up, and she's actually an air attack. So she's an aerial commander. She flies around the fires, and she, coordinates the airplanes and helicopters that are fighting the blazes.
We're talking to Kyle Dickman about his book On the Burning Edge. Firefighters seem to love fire itself. Starting fires, watching fires, putting out fires. Explain to us what that's like.
I mean, it's so dynamic, right? Like, and I mean, well, there's two parts of it. I mean, like, I can't imagine anybody who sits around a campfire and isn't just mesmerized by, you know, the dancing of the flames. But then take that and, you know, scale it up hundreds of times. And there's just something incredible about watching, you know, it's like nature has no ends. It's just the power is unbelievable. And so when you watch an entire, you know, forest burst into flames, it's pretty incredible. The other thing is that the men and women want to fight fire because they spend their summers training for it. And so, you know, you want to put into action what you've been preparing for.
at the same time, there is, and you devote a very important and interesting chapter to this, there are some really poor policies that started getting put in place about 100 years ago, driven actually by the timber industry, that led to the kind of fire suppression that has created ecological havoc, particularly in the dry Southwest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where to start? So, yeah, I mean, I think 1910 is basically when we started actively suppressing fires. And we got really good at it by the 1950s. We were suppressing about 98% of blazes before they reached the size of a city block. The consequence of that, I think it's pretty well understood now, but is most western forests were adapted to fire. And in the absence of flames, you had forests grow incredibly thick. So here in New Mexico, for instance, on 1 acre of land, there's 1,300 trees per acre, where a century ago, there was just 150. And so when a fire does start...
Oh, my God. It's almost 10 times as much.
Oh, it's incredibly thick. I mean, if you've walked around the forest in Santa Fe Not in the pinyon and juniper so much, but up in the ponderosa, and you can just see it's like where if you have to imagine that used to look quote unquote park like, you know, with grass or low brush, and then these big ponderosa pines. And today it's these big ponderosa pines, and then filled in with, you know, white fir or aspens. And so when a fire does start, it works like a ladder. It can climb up from the bottom and jump up into the middle layer, and then up into the crowns. And once the fire's in the crowns, the trees, you can't stop the fire.
And it's also, I mean, the kind of fire to which forests are naturally adapted is healthy for the ecosystem and all the creatures living in it, but the kind of fires that we have now, not so much.
Not so much, yeah. They're burning way too intense. It's much too hot. So look at the Las Conchas fire just outside of Santa Fe in 2011. I mean, much of what burned out there, we're never going to see it return. And I think, you know, that's what's really tragic about the whole thing, is because, you know, I love America's forests. You know, I spend every free moment that I have in them. And knowing that we've lost this, what once was this beautiful ponderosa forest, and that's never going to return, I think that's actually sort of heartbreaking. And I think that's really what's so important about getting the policies right.
Tell us about the role of the timber industry at the get-go in forming these policies.
Sure. So Teddy Roosevelt founded the Forest Service in 1905. Congress sets the budgets for all agencies, and Congress was not a huge fan of Teddy Roosevelt, and so what they did is they said, you can't have any money. And so they gave him this really anemic budget. The Rangers used to have to pay for their own horses, their own feed, their own tools. And basically nobody believed the Forest Service was going to survive beyond its infancy. And then in 1910, this fire starts in Idaho, burns 3 million acres of timber, and the timber industry sees every blackened tree as a dollar lost. And so they suddenly felt this, and actually the guys who were fighting that fire were all Forest Service Rangers. And so suddenly the Congress saw a purpose for the Forest Service. They said, these guys can go out and they can stop fire from burning our trees. And the result of that is you had basically a coupling of the Forest Service and the timber industry. And so that lasted up until the 70s and the 80s. And then in the 70s and 80s, you had the rise of the environmental movement, the Endangered Species Act, and you had sort of an awakening among environmentalists about fire's role in the systems. And shortly thereafter, the timber industry collapsed in the Forest Service lands. It's down to like 30% of what it once was at its heyday. But the fire policies never changed. And so firefighters are continuing to suppress all these fires. But the timber, we're no longer thinning the forest. And so the result is that more fuel, hotter fires, more destruction.
It's also kind of an object lesson about what happens. Like, okay, the timber industry wants every tree saved for their own profitable purposes, which eventually leads to trees getting so complete, forests getting so burned that there's not a tree left, and we'll never. I mean, it's the right opposite of what they wanted in the first place.
Yeah, but you know, I think they probably, by the time that was true, they didn't care because they'd already made their millions. You know, yeah, it is an interesting relationship. But it's not really the case anymore. I mean, I'm actually an advocate of more logging on public lands at this point, because I think you need to see it. I think you need to be responsible logging. We don't want to see a return to the clear-cutting days of the 70s and the 80s, but we do need to be out there, and we need to see more timber harvest from public lands, because otherwise, in the absence of that, you're going to see more fires like Las Conchas, because more fuel to burn and the rest of it.
Now, in your view, is there a kind of logging that most closely approximates or imitates the effect of a healthy fire?
I think that you have to do it hand in hand. So it's not that logging doesn't, like, you can't only do logging. You have to do logging, and then you have to thin the forest out and prepare it so that when you do start a fire, or a fire does burn in there, it's not catastrophic. But you have to have both. And I mean, you know, we've all seen logged landscapes. They tend to be ugly, and yeah, it tends to take a long time for that land to recover. And so, but you know, I do think we need to be seeing both more fire on the landscape and more logging.
Now, the fires that you describe in this book, and we're talking about a wonderful book called On the Burning Edge, these fires are so terrifying. I mean, when trees are burned, this is something I had no idea, when trees are burned on that scale and at that heat, the water from the leaves and from the trees goes into the air, creates its own weather, creates thunderstorms that in their own way become catastrophes, and their people can get caught, and even helicopters can get caught in columns of air that are incredibly dangerous. There's stories and, you know, burning trees sending branches 1,000 feet into the air. Yeah. I mean, it's apocalyptic.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. I mean, it's the power of nature. I mean, some of these things, some of these fires burn like volcanic eruptions. And yeah, it's just incredible. So, I mean, I think that's also part of the reason that people love the work. It's like, you get to go out and watch just this amazing natural phenomena, you know? And yeah, it's destructive, but it's also, it's not, there are fires in the historic record that there are instances of fires in the historic record burning just as intensely as we're seeing today. But it was just that they were more, they were less common. So now we're seeing a higher frequency of highly destructive blazes, whereas before we saw a higher frequency of low intensity blazes. But, you know, if you wonder why fires get so much coverage in the press these days, it's because I can tell you that when Las Conchas started, the first thing I did is I got into my truck, drove to the top of a hill at La Tierra, and I stood out there and I looked out at the fire, and I put my arms out and was like, oh my God, this is a sight. You know, it was really just an incredible thing to witness.
I was driving back from Albuquerque the night that it started, and we didn't know that it had started. On the hill was this, on this sort of light, and we were like, is that Los Alamos? Yeah. Is that what is, and we realized it was, and it felt like the end of the world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so primal.
Yeah. Oh, it is. And it's, yeah, it's, and fires like that are truly terrifying, you know, truly terrifying. So,
and it's interesting that you say, you know, these are the forces of nature, and yeah, some of these kinds of highly destructive fires did exist in the past, not as often as they do now. And the fact that they happen as often as they do now makes them almost kind of man-made events.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to look at it. You know, I think, you know, we just talked about fire policy, but, you know, we can also, climate change is also there's an element of climate change in there. So we've seen a 1.7 degree increase in temperature since the 1970s. We're expected to see a 4 to 6 degree increase by the end of this century. And so the idea is that more warmer air holds more moisture than cooler air. And so if the temperature increases, you're going to see that moisture wicked out of the forest. And so it's going to further prime the forest for high intensity fires. But those two things, you know, denser forests, warmer climate, and are creating more intense fires. But the reason that it matters is because there are now 140 million people living in fire-prone areas. And so
Right. You
have to look at fires and say, you know, they're not natural disasters until they burn something that we value. And there are now so many things that we value in the West that there are more fires that are becoming natural disasters. And I think as a result of that, the agencies feel a lot of pressure to treat all fires like they're natural disasters, because you have to prevent these small fires. You have to stop small fires from becoming big fires. And the paradox is, every time you do that, you're basically doubling down on a failed policy and creating a larger fire the next time one comes around.
We're talking to Kyle Dickman about his book, On the Burning Edge, A Fateful Fire and the Men Who Fought It. L- let's talk a little bit more about policy. There was a part of the book where you talked about studies that have been done about how fires are fought and recommendations for different ways, different methods and practices of fighting fires and managing fires. That knowledge hasn't actually seeped into practice yet. What could we be doing differently?
Well, I think I'll start by saying that, yeah, so what we're doing is we're continuing to do the things that we've always done, which is we're really continuing to fight fires really aggressively. I think what it's going to take to change that is actually going to take a cultural shift within the agencies. And so the Forest Service tends to be, the Forest Service right now, 50% of the Forest Service's budget is dedicated to fire. Most of that goes to fire suppression. Most people who are staffed in high-level positions in the Forest Service come from fire. And so really, if you look at it, that agency, I mean, it's called the Forest Service, but in many ways, it's the fire service. So I think if we're going to see changes in the Forest Service, it's going to have to start within the agency, and we're going to have to see more people brought into high-level positions that aren't necessarily related to fire. So I think basically we want to see a shift of priorities.
What would that mean for, I mean, okay, a fire breaks out. What could or should be done differently?
Well, so there are, well, I think what we need to do, and actually we're seeing some of this. So I can't remember the name of the fire. Was it Juarezco or something like that? It was a fire just north of Santa Fe. It was in 2013. It was a huge fire, but they let it burn. So it started in the wilderness, and they didn't send any firefighters on to actually aggressively suppress it. They just sent managers to watch it and make sure that it didn't, you know, burn anything that people valued. So I think what we'll see more of in the future, and I think a good proactive way to deal with fires, is called point protection. So instead of having a fire and putting the entire fire out, you send firefighters to the blaze and you say, look, it's going to burn toward these ranches, or it's going to burn toward Los Alamos or Santa Fe. So what instead of fighting the entire fire, you just protect Santa Fe. Effectively, you create a moat around the town, and you let the fire burn into that moat, sit down, and then burn around it.
There are so many people who have built a lone house in the woods. That's what makes it hard.
Yeah, that's what makes it hard. But I'll be the first to say that. I mean, right now, the way that we treat Forest Service or basically wildland firefighters, it's like a public service. But so we're expected, these homeowners in the wilderness expect the federal government, the state government, county governments to send wildland firefighters out to protect their houses. But I would actually advocate that it's the homeowners' responsibilities to protect their houses, because if they create defensible space beforehand, if they use chainsaws and chippers to thin out the brush around their house, it's no longer the responsibility of the Forest Service or the firefighters protect that house, because, in effect, that house has already been protected.
One of the things that I thought was interesting in your book was that after a really big fire, people started actually showing up to meetings about fire safety and about how to make those spaces around their house.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. It takes that, and actually, it takes that, I think, on a federal level too. I mean, I was just talking to a former incident commander, a guy who's been at fires for 40 years, and we were talking about how we're going to change policies, and he said, "I think the only way we're going to change policy is we're going to have to see something in fire of the same scale like Katrina. You know, it's like we're going to have to see Denver burn, for instance. And then I think when something like that happens,
God forbid,
Oh, I know, it'd be terrible. But I think that's sort of attention grabbing event that we're going to need to see.
Yeah. Now let's get back to the book and this whole question of the 19 firefighters who lost their lives. Hotshot firefighters, amazing people. You describe each of their lives, and it's a very personal book in the sense that we get to know them and their families and girlfriends and adventures and things that, it's a sort of beautiful memorial to these men. But there are safety procedures and guidelines for firefighters, and one of them involves safety zones. What are safety zones in a wildfire?
Safety zones are places that firefighters can sort of weather a firestorm without having to deploy their fire shelters, these sort of aluminum tents that firefighters use in a last-ditch effort. So they can retreat to a safety zone, and the fire can burn around them, and they won't be burned.
Now, one kind of safety zone is the part of the forest that's already been burned, the charred black of the forest.
That's right, yep.
And so if you retreat into that, it's not going to burn again because it's already been burned. Describe these little aluminum shelters. I couldn't quite visualize them in my mind. They seem really scary.
Well, they're pretty scary. You don't ever want to use them. You really don't want to use them. But they're about, so they sit on the back of your pack, underneath the bottom of the pack, and this sort of bread box size red case. And so you pull, so when you need them, and God forbid you need them, you pull out this shelter, and it's folded in, it's sort of accordioned into this thing, and you rip it out, and you flick it out, and it creates a tent. You know, it's this little aluminum tent. And you crawl under the tent, and the idea is the aluminum will reflect the heat. But they're not designed to withstand direct contact with flame. And they're also, they're not designed to withstand a certain temperature threshold. So, and I can't remember exactly what that is, but what I do know is that in Yarnell they were experiencing temperatures of, in excess of 2,000 degrees. And so those shelters were not, those shelters just completely destroyed. They delaminated, the aluminum melted, chainsaws were just completely destroyed. All the plastic was gone. The only thing left of hand tools was the metal heads. Wood was gone. The radios were destroyed. Everything was sort of melted together into these masses of these horrifying objects.
And at the same time, in lesser fires or fires where somebody has survived under some of these little aluminum shelters, they can still get to incredibly hot temperatures inside these things and have people survive.
Yeah, I mean, they do work. That's why firefighters carry them. But they work, and the idea is that you should, you never want to use them. You want to reach a safety zone like the black before you have to deploy your fire shelter. But in the event that you deploy your fire shelter, you want to be in a place that is far enough away from brush or trees so that the temperatures stay low enough that you can survive.
One of the firefighters survived because he was the lookout. He was able to get to safety. Brendan McDonough, also known as Donut. What was it like for him to be the only surviving member of the Granite Mountain Hotshots?
I think it was absolutely devastating. It's exactly what you would expect. He has this really. He's fighting PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. He's fighting survivor's guilt. But in addition to those two things, he also had this really bizarre experience where he went from one member of 20 on a hotshot crew, basically an anonymous person in the world of the 56,000 wildland firefighters. One day, that was his position on June 29th. On July 1st, he was the face of wildland firefighters, and he was sort of the darling of the nation. And he went, he was on the Today Show, and he was accepting grants or checks for $500,000 from the Arizona Diamondbacks, and he was brought on stage at pop country concerts, and there were girls in spaghetti strap shirts screaming his name. We love you, Donut. And all of this happened, all of this fame happened because he was the only one who survived when 19 of his closest friend died. And so it really was a perverse dynamic. And his psychologist said, I don't know how it is that we're going to help you, but we're going to figure it out.
We're talking to Kyle Dickman about the book On the Burning Edge. There were also two other firefighters who were part of this this crew, this community, who survived. One was attending the birth of his child. The other was out for medical reasons. Did they also have some of that survivor's guilt?
I don't think to the same extent. Both of those men had made the choice. Less so, and one of the guys' name was Renan. He was on a fire. They'd worked a very long shift. He was exhausted, and he woke up in the middle of the night, basically seizing. His back was cramping up. He had incredible pain, and he for medical reasons, he was forced to leave the fire line. The other guy's case, he was having the birth of his third child, and so he had made the decision to leave the fire line to be with his wife and be with his family. So I think, that because they both either actively made that choice or were forced into it, I don't think they felt the same way as Donut. Donut, where Donut, it was, you know, strictly fate that saved his life.
What was it like for you as a former hotshot firefighter to write this book? You're a journalist, but you're also somebody who was very deeply, who could very deeply identify with what they went through.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of, so, I think a lot of the reason I wanted to write the book is because initially I'd done, the book came out of a story that I'd done for Outside Magazine. And during the interview process, I could see these guys, you know, not, I could see myself in so many of them. And I could see, you know, these guys that I had spent years working with in so many of them. And I really felt like, you know, I'd never met them. But I really did feel like I knew certainly the situations that they were in, and I felt like, you know, I felt a deep connection to them. And so, and when I was having these conversations with the widows or you know, the parents or brothers, sisters, whatever it was, they couldn't simply, it's not as if what I wanted to talk about was what happened on June 30th, the day of the Yarnell Hill fire. But for them, they couldn't compartmentalize their loved one's life into that single day. And so what they would do is they would, we would start, the interviews ended up having a very similar rhythm. We would start talking and we would say, you know, I'd say, well, tell me about, you know, Robert Caldwell. Tell me about Robert Caldwell. And so, and I would talk to his wife, and she would start, well, tell me how you guys met. And we would start there, you know, and then we would go, we'd advance slowly forward, and eventually we would reach the day of June 30th. And she knew that's what I was there to talk to her about. And then I think, and then things got really hard, and almost every time they would break down, and, you know, I would sit patiently and watch as she grieved. And then, we would go back to a moment that gave her an opportunity to remember her loved one, her husband. And she would tell me that some sort of sweet detail, and then she would regain her strength, and then we'd go back to the day of the 30th, and we'd move forward again. And so, and that, you know, I think hearing these guys, hearing about their lives, all of their lives, you know, not just them as firefighters, is what made me want to write about them.
It probably, I would guess, I mean, the fact that you had done that job and that you were sort of part of that club made it easier to build trust with the survivors and their families.
Yeah, they, you know, well, there's a vernacular for fire in fire, just like any profession. And I think it's easier for people to talk to you when they can say, yeah, we were cutting line, and I don't have to be like, well, what's cutting line, or, you know, we were burning out. And there's all these terms that they could just use, and so we could focus on what was actually happening, and you know, not have to spend time defining things. And I think, and I also think that they just, I think that they did trust me because I had experience, and I knew that, you know, if we talked about hazing, it's, you know, maybe one of the guys was hazing another one of the guys, but, and you know, more often than not, it's not mean-spirited, it's just the culture of the job. And I think that they trusted that I wouldn't write it in a judgmental way. Maybe I did in some cases, but I don't think so.
No, it's very much of a narrative in which we feel, we the readers, feel like we are there. We're watching every step, and I couldn't help but, you know, be really impressed by your job of piecing that narrative together, because most of the people who could tell it were gone.
Yeah, that was really hard, but we talked earlier about two of the guys who survived the fire, not Donut. Donut was, of course, a key source, but Donut was also so exhausted from having to talk to the media all the time that there was a certain, my experience with him is he only had a certain threshold. He could only talk about his experience so much, and I just think he was just absolutely devastated. And so I didn't want to push him too hard. And so a lot of the stories came from the two other surviving sources, Brandon Bunch and Renan Packer. And I spent a lot of time talking to those guys. I spent a lot of time talking to Heather Kennedy, who was the girlfriend of one of the hotshots who was killed. A lot of time talking to, well, family members and whatever else, but also firefighters that the men interacted with on blazes that they had worked before Yarnell Hill. And so for me, that was actually, I think, the most thrilling part of it, because I don't love writing about 19 young men dying. That, you know, that hurt, you know. But I loved writing about, you know, these men living, and I loved watching their sort of lives, and there's moments that I got to see video of these guys. And just watching them alive was like, oh, hey, look, he's doing exactly what it is that I figured that he was going to do based on these stories that, you know, his wife or whatever else had told me. And so that was really fun for me.
When you look at this fire and having pieced together what you pieced together, I mean, one of the things that you make very clear is that when somebody is on a crew, the person who is in a leadership position, you follow that person blindly. You don't second guess them. What happened on that night, on that day, was they left the safety zone. Mm-hmm. And there has been much speculation about why they did that, who made the mistake, whether it was a mistake, how that mistake was made. What actually happened that you know? What can you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, what we know is that that around 3:30 in the afternoon, a thunderhead developed over Yarnell. The thunderhead put out 30 to 40 mile an hour winds. The fire rapidly changed direction, and it started running toward the town of Yarnell. We know that the Granite Mountain Hotshots at that point decided to move. They were cutting line up on a ridge line above the town of Yarnell. We know that they decided to pull back into the black. They could see everything that happened. And then around 4 o'clock, they made the decision to leave the safety of the black, walk a mile and a half toward the town of Yarnell to a safety zone called the Helms Place, and that would have put them in a position to help homeowners when the town burned. Ultimately, of course, they never reached it. They dropped down into a box canyon. They lost sight of the fire, and 80-foot flame swept over the men and killed them within 2 minutes of seeing the fire. So those are the facts. And so the question is, you know, what motivated them to leave it? And I think what's interesting about this fire, I mean, first off, there are a lot of fatality fires in the history of wildland firefighting. You know, there have been dozens of incidents. You know, more than 1,000 firefighters have died fighting fires. What's interesting about this one in particular is there's a certain amount of gray area. We know, A, that they left the black, and we know that 40 minutes later, 19 men were dead in the bottom of a basin. And nobody really knew where they were. So there had been, you know, the radio communications had been cryptic. They weren't clear that they were heading back to the town of Yarnell. And so it left a lot of unanswerable questions. And I think that because of that, there's, you know, I think that this fire in particular spawned a sort of a passionate following of citizen journalists who are really working hard to try to figure out exactly what happened out that day.
A passionate following of citizen journalists is a very diplomatic way of putting it.
It's a diplomatic way of putting it. But I think they have a right to be curious. And I think, you know, so with this one, they made a lot of... there's two official investigations into the tragedy after it happened. All of the raw materials used to create those investigations were made public. So there's this incredible trove of information that's available for anybody who wants it. And some people, you know, there's, I don't know how many there are, dozens maybe, who have just scoured this material. And it's really, I don't know. I mean, to me, it's a little bit insane. I think it's a little bit insane. I do. That they spend hours and hours and hours doing what I had done to write this book. But they're doing it, and I don't think, I think that everybody is looking for a magic bullet, and they're looking for an answer that doesn't necessarily exist. And I also think if that answer does exist, it doesn't change the narrative. And more importantly, it's not going to save lives in the future. And I think that needs to be the ultimate direction of why we look into this stuff. With that being said, I also think it's really valuable that you have all this interest in it, because it is possible that these guys find something, and that little shred of information sheds light on this incident a little bit differently, and maybe that changes things in the future.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, is there anything that came out of lessons learned about this fire that has affected policies or standards about how fires are fought?
Not yet. Not really. I mean, so there's some movement in the House right now, which is great. I'm forgetting the name, but there's at least three bills. The president has a bill forth about wildfire funding. The Republicans have a bill put forth about wildfire funding. And John McCain has one, and then also Oregon Senator Ron Wyden has a bill put forth. And so... A lot of people in the House are really interested, and the Senate are really interested in trying to solve the wildfire crisis. And I don't think Yarnell, there isn't a clear enough takeaway from Yarnell that people are saying, this is where the buck stops. This is where everything needs to change. There's so much gray area there that I think when we look at it, it's worth looking at it in the big picture context and saying, like, here's why fires are burning more intensely. You know, here's why 140 million people have something to really worry about when fires start. And here's why if we continue down this track, we have to expect to see more Yarnell Hills.
My takeaway from it as a reader of your book, like from what you gave us as readers, was that here were these men who were safe in the black, the charred area, the safety zone, and they made a choice to go to another safety zone where they could help instead of staying in a safety zone where they couldn't do anything and where they would have had to sit for hours and hours and basically watch this destructive fire burn and have their hands tied. Mm-hmm. And when you have a group of people who are so able to help and so capable
and trained to be that way,
sitting still in the black isn't really what you want to do. And so, you know, like I read this, I was like, maybe they took a really poorly conceived risk.
Yeah, death by the best of intentions, I think is really what it was. And yeah, I mean, I think that's it. And I think, you know, I think there was also there are more human factors than simply that involved. I think in this case, you had a superintendent who was Eric Marsh, who hadn't been with the crew all year. And he had a history of not the best decision making. He was sort of insecure. And he had just only on June 30th really taken command of the crew again. And the number two in command was a guy named Jesse Steed, who was this 6'2", hugely charismatic guy, and all the men really coalesced around him. And I think that there was some tension between Marsh and Steed, and I think, you know, ultimately it was Marsh's decision for the men to leave the black, and I think that part of that had to do with, you know, if they had reached the safety zone, I think it could have been a real coup for them, or at least I think, you know, that's how they saw it. It was a real coup that they'd showed up and were now in position to help homeowners whose lives were soon to be destroyed.
There was a phrase that had been applied to this firefighter, Eric Marsh, bad decisions, good outcomes. That was like part of how people saw him.
That's part of, yeah, I think superintendents and other superintendents, hotshot superintendents in the region did feel that way about Eric Marsh. But I think it's worth taking that with a grain of salt because you have to keep in mind that Eric Marsh was the leader of a crew. I mean, he was the leader of the crew that 19 men died on. You know, the amount of scrutiny that's going to come to him, and it's well deserved, is you know, it's staggering. And so I think that that in hindsight, when people look back at this, they're going to see there's a tendency to see all of the bad decisions that Eric Marsh made in his career. To inflate the significance of those decisions, because I think that if he hadn't have died and if he hadn't have led these men to death, then I don't think that he would have been looked poorly on as a superintendent of a hotshot crew. And it just so happened that he was the leader of the men that day when they died. And I guess the reason I'm saying that isn't to defend Marsh. I think that his decision to leave the black was a mistake. I also think that it was forgivable. And the reason that I think it's forgivable is that I think that it's the type of decision that as much as I think firefighters would like to say I would never do that, I do think it's the type of decision, even if it's not that exact one, that it's possible that men will make in the future.
What did investigations that took place after this fire turn up? Did they agree with you that it was a bad decision but a forgivable decision?
I don't think anybody put it in those terms. I mean, of course, that they're investigations, so they're a little bit drier to begin with. But so the first investigation was conducted by the state of Arizona, and what it found was effectively that no mistakes were made. And I thought that was a really strange conclusion to reach, because I don't think it, you know, I don't see it being particularly useful to say it's all Eric Marsh's fault or it's all the incident commander's fault. I don't think that's helpful either, but I do think it's worth being honest about why, you know, what happened out there. So I wasn't quite sure why they were so sensitive to that. The second investigation was done by OSHA, and what they found is that the incident command teams had been negligent, and they had risked
firefighter lives to protect houses that couldn't be saved. And so they ultimately fined the state of Arizona $500,000, which isn't necessarily a ton of money, but I do think it's a slap on the wrist. And I think what their point was is that incident commanders and management teams need to be realistic about what it is that their men can do, men and women can do to stop fires. And so I think the takeaway there was, you know, that's a pretty valuable thing for firefighters to take heart.
Have you ever been drawn back to the profession of firefighting?
Oh, yeah. So in 2012, I went back to, I embedded with my old hotshot crew for a story for Outside, which is really how the whole thing started for me. But now I miss the simplicity of it. You know, I do. I miss going out in the woods and, you know, working all day and going home and being done with it. And I guess I miss the clarity of purpose too. You know, I think when firefighters fight fires, when you're a hotshot, just a crew member, your job is to put the fire out. It's kind of black and white, you know, and it's like, that's really a wonderful thing. You just work all day. That's not to oversimplify things. I mean, there are a lot of hard decisions that commanders have to make on the line and superintendents, whatever else. But for a hotshot, it's pretty simple.
What is your takeaway, having written this book? What was it like for you writing it and now having it finished?
Oh, it's always, I mean, it's my first book, but I'll tell you that it's strange. I mean, it's like I spent a year and a half or 2 years of my life, you know, everything was about this book. Like I couldn't leave it. Like I would go on vacation and my mind was always just wrapping around these stories and figuring out what to include, what not to include. And then one day it's done. And I'd be lying if I said that, you know, only a good thing. To be honest with you, it felt a little bit empty because there was this project that had been all consuming for so long. And then you have to deal with the fact that, okay, now I've written it and now it goes out into the world and I can no longer, the only thing that I can control is what I had done, which was the product and not how it's received by the people, you know, people. And so it's been an interesting process, but it's been good too. I mean, I've definitely, you know, there was a month or two that you just kind of sit there and you're like, well, what do I do now? But at this point, you know, I've certainly moved on. I'm working on a lot of stories, working on features for Outside and PopSci and blah, blah, blah. So, but yeah, I'm also ready to take on a new book, I guess.
We will look forward to that. Kyle Dickman is a contributing editor at Outside Magazine. He's a former hotshot firefighter, and he's author of the new book, On the Burning Edge, A Fateful Fire and the Men Who Fought It. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.